How kind of you to invite me to preach in this great church. I did not know how high this pulpit was, or I might have accepted Michael's invitation to preach down on the chancel. But on the other hand, when people ask, have you ever preached in the West End pulpit? I want to say, yes, I have. And when it was over, my friends talked me down. Seriously, I've never been to Nashville, although my teacher and mentor, Fred Craddock, studied across the street. And Bob Funk, who formed the Jesus Seminar, of which I'm now a member, taught at Vanderbilt. So life is a poignant circle. I do want to make it clear, however, that I am not here with the NRA. I'm sure that's shocking to you. I represent the Jesus-following wing of the Christian church. If we have a Second Amendment, it would be something like this. The practice of love and compassion being necessary to the future of a well-regulated church. That the right of the people to follow Jesus instead of worshiping Christ shall not be infringed. One of my responsibilities at the university is to teach my students critical thinking, which, if you haven't noticed, is something of a lost art. And one of the areas of logic we practice is called deductive or syllogistic logic. It sounds complicated, but we're all familiar with it. It sounds like this. All men are mortal, major premise. Socrates is a man, minor premise. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Sometimes people will just drop the first or major premise, all men are mortal, because everyone knows that's true. Often we do not express our first premises because we assume them. And in Greek logic, any assumed first premise is called an enthymeme. E-N-T-H-Y-M-E-M-E. Makes a great password for your computer because nobody's ever heard of it. A more modern example would be this. Rogaine grows hair, therefore bald men love Rogaine. Nobody thinks to state the major premise, bald men would prefer to have hair because we assume it. It's an enthymeme. The church has many assumed first premises, things we assume are true even if we have reason to doubt them, and the granddaddy of them all is original sin. To put this in the form of the sublime and the ridiculous, all bald men may not wish to have hair. And humans may not be born bad or born into sin, as the church puts it. That first premise determines the outcome of all Orthodox Christian arguments. But what if it's not true? What if we are born as an original blessing, to use the title of a book by Matthew Fox, you and me and everything else, and we don't need to be saved so much as we need to be restored? To remember where we came from, where we're going, and to whom we belong. The church is awash in so-called developed doctrines, those first premises that are nowhere to be found in the Bible. Take original sin, the idea that we're born into sin, we inherit it from our first parents, Adam and Eve, that we arrive in the world, if you will, as little sinners, trapped by the transgressions of those who came before us, because sin is a birthright, like red hair or left-handedness. It says that we sin because we are sinners, rather than that we are sinners because we sin. And that's no small distinction. Original sin renders us helpless. Original blessing says we have a choice. And you've got to hand it to the church. They provided all of humanity with a diagnosis for a disease for which only the church had the cure. That would be the ultimate spiritual franchise. You see, if you can keep the masses from challenging your assumed premises, you have enormous power. Take the idea of the divine right of kings. The divine right of kings enslaved humanity for centuries till someone got up and said, the king is not divine. The emperor has no clothes. The earth is not the center of the universe. So the church put Copernicus under house arrest for being right. The doctrine of original sin, as we understand it in the church, is nowhere to be found in the Hebrew Bible or in the New Testament either. Of course, we have this wonderful story in Genesis in which a mythical couple, Adam and Eve, who have everything they need but not everything they want, choose to sin and get us all kicked out of the garden. I call it a myth not because it's not true, but because it contains a truth larger than mere facts can convey. The instructions to Adam and Eve are clear. Do as you please, but don't do one thing. Don't eat the fruit of one tree in the middle of the garden, or you will die. Nonsense, says the serpent. Go for it. It'll open your eyes, and you'll become like God, knowing good and evil. Besides, if we are told, any of us, exactly what not to do, isn't that exactly what we begin to want to do? So, the woman partakes, of course, because the story is written by a man. She partakes, and then she recommends it to Adam, the little temptress, and immediately they realize what? That they are naked, i.e., they discover shame. But the best part of the story is the passing of the buck. When confronted with the transgression, Adam blames the woman, and she blames the snake. It's the first example of the victimhood mentality, where no one is ever to blame for anything else. Someone else is to blame. The epicenter of this disease, by the way, is located in Washington, D.C. That's someone else's fault. The Bible's full of stories that are etiological. That is, they're written to explain how things got to be the way they are now, and then the story is placed retroactively in the record, so that it will act kind of like the cinematic concept of the prequel. Look around. The world's a mess and humans are deeply flawed. It can't be God's fault. So we created a story in which once we were perfect, but we chose to do exactly what we were told not to do. And what is the sentence that gets handed down by God? That women should give birth in great pain and that men should work by the sweat of their brow until they die in dusty fields. We can relate to this in Oklahoma. The story serves to explain why, to use a Buddhist phrase, what is, is. Once we were perfect, frolicking blissfully in paradise, God's work was perfect, but because we chose to sin, we now suffer the consequences. We've all been kicked out of the garden. We all live, as Steinbeck put it, east of Eden. But the story does not say we sin because we can't help ourselves. It says we often choose to sin, and then we suffer the consequences. It was not until centuries later that the church created the doctrine of original sin. It was primarily Augustine's doing, and he never did quite reconcile body and soul. And he essentially took free will away when it came to sinning. We're all helpless and hopeless until we get Jesus, which, as you very well know, eliminates all sinning. Well, no, of course, we still sin, but now we're forgiven. You've seen the bumper sticker. I'm not perfect, just forgiven. Now, they call it original sin, which, by the way, led one stand-up comic to say, I'm all for original sin. I think if one is going to sin, one ought to be original about it. But in fact, the doctrine of the church makes unoriginal sinners out of all of us. We are just doing the same old, stupid, nasty stuff all the time because we can't help ourselves. That's not very original. I saw a sign once in front of a church in Oklahoma, one of those wayside pulpits that announced the sermon title, and it read in big block letters, "If you're done with sin, then come on in." I thought, that's kind of clever. Then I drew closer. I saw someone had written another message just underneath it in small letters, looked like lipstick. It said, "But if you're not quite through, call 272. So what if Matthew Fox is right? What if we are born not into original sin, but as an original blessing? Here's what I believe. Over the centuries, the church has unwittingly been part of a sort of grand ecclesiastical put-down of the human race. We have focused so much of our energy on teaching people to be humble that we've forgotten how to embrace the idea that we are born in the image of God, made in the image of God, captured by that beautiful Latin phrase, imago Dei. Made in the image of God, that is our original first premise, and it's in the Bible. I'll never forget the day years ago I reported as a seventh grader to what we used to call homeroom. You remember homeroom? You'd go there the first day, get your schedule, they'd call your name, and then you'd head out to your classes. Very important moment, homeroom, because it's the first time that the names of students are read aloud, and thus their identity is established. On that particular morning, the teacher read the name of a particular girl and then stopped and peered over her glasses and says, "Is so-and-so your father?" "Yes," the girl replied. "And is so-and-so your brother?" "Yes, ma'am." You see, both the father and the brother had served prison terms on drug charges. Then the teacher said in front of the class, "Well, I sure hope you're not like them." Now, how do you think that girl felt? I personally believe the teacher should have been arrested, charged with a rhetorical crime against humanity. When we project an expectation of failure, that's usually what we get. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Have you heard that? It's cute. The only problem is, it's not true. Sticks and stones can indeed break our bones, but words can totally destroy us. Why do we put one another down so often? Is it because we think we'll get too high an opinion of ourselves and thus become arrogant? Most arrogant people I know are that way because they don't have a very high opinion of themselves. Not really. They're insecure. Or as my friend the rabbi put it, a man who does not love himself wisely and well will make a casualty out of the neighbor sooner or later. In fact, we so distrust our own goodness, our real birthright, which is imago Dei, that the word human has now been joined with a certain given weakness or fallibility. For example, a baseball player strikes out, but not because the pitcher threw the perfect curveball, but because the batter is only human. Your grandmother, the one who bakes those cakes, those three-layer jobs that come out of the oven like a work of art and taste like sunshine in your mouth because nobody bakes them like your granny. But one day something goes wrong. Nobody's perfect. The cake falls, as they say, flat as the sole of your shoe. And what does granny say? "Well, child, I'm only human." Well, what I want to know is this. What was she when she baked the perfect cake? What was the baseball player when he hit the grand slam or made the diving catch? Human. We seem to want to talk about our humanness as a way of explaining failure, but not as a way of explaining success. It's original sin over original blessing again. Listen to this. To err is human, to forgive divine. See how the pie is sliced? Humans also forgive, do they not? I can tell you from personal experience, we have three children. Most children do not start out in this world all sort of afflicted with excessive and crippling humility. No, kids don't come into the world all stooped over from self-loathing. They have to have that drilled into them. You take, for example, a 9-year-old boy gets an A in arithmetic, and he's on his way home from school carrying this grade card with this A on it, and he is not the picture of humility as he walks home from school. He says, "Look at that. That's an A right there, baby. Not a B, not a C. Oh, what's her name? Never gives A's to anybody. Check it out. It's an A. Think I'm going to skip junior high, high school, go straight to college. Look at that." Now, you take that same boy 30 years later. He's a civic leader. He's community-minded. He's been the head of some important project. And they call him up to receive an award for his work. And what does he do? Stares at the floor, counts his shoelaces, mumbles a few words of thanks for all the forgotten people who made it possible and his grandmother who came over on a covered wagon. You know, sometimes I just wish people would get up and say, "Thank you, I deserve this." In fact, this thing ought to be made of solid gold the way I worked on this project. A man named Edgar Lee Masters from Spoon River, Illinois, wrote a bunch of poems once and called them the Spoon River Anthology. Basically, they're all framed on one idea. The people in Spoon River have all died. And now that they're dead, they're telling the truth. One of them is named Constance Hadley. And this is what she said. "You praised my self-sacrifice, Spoon River, for rearing Irene and Mary, orphans of my older sister. And you censured Irene and Mary's contempt of me. Don't praise my self-sacrifice, and don't censure their contempt of me. I cared for them, it's true enough, but I poisoned all my benefactions to them by constant reminders of their dependence on me." Do you know what she means? It sounds like this. "As long as you girls set foot under my table, as long as you sleep under this roof, remember who took you in when your mother died." In other words, every kind word was accompanied by a reminder of the indebtedness of the recipient. Is it any wonder that the people we try to help so often end up hating us for it? When I was a boy serving, I wasn't serving as a boy, I just was growing up in Wichita, Kansas. I was a double PK, son of a preacher, son of a professor. I haven't fallen far from this tree. My home church was Plymouth Congregational Church, and we had something around Christmas called the Annual Christmas Project. We didn't really do a lot of benevolence work the rest of the year, but around Christmas time, we knew we had to show how much we cared. Inspired by the Jesus who is the reason for the season and on fire to help the needy and put Christ back in Christmas and all that, a bunch of us from the youth group set out to spread love and joy. But we never thought for one minute we were being condescending about it. We made these baskets for the poor. And then we dared to go into what we called in those days the ghetto to distribute them. And we felt good about it. In fact, we were proud as peacocks. First, we collected money somehow. I don't remember exactly how we got the money. Probably a car wash or a rummage sale, or we embezzled from our parents. I don't know, but we got the money somehow. And then we called the Department of Social Services, and we asked them on the phone very matter-of-factly, "Who are the poor in this community?" And they gave us a list of needy families. And we bought fruit and candy and apples and oranges and bananas. We put them all in this sack. We put the sack in a basket, tied a bow on top, put a little card in there with a Hallmark verse about the true meaning of Christmas, and off we went to make deliveries. But we knew how important it was to be humble, because the Christmas story is humble, the baby Jesus is humble, the manger, well, nothing if not humble. So this is how we did it. First, we'd go up on the front porch with the basket and knock on the door. Knocking on the door. And when we heard the person who lived in that little shack coming, we'd yell, "Merry Christmas!" And then we'd run and jump in the car and drive on to the next house. See, we were more interested in making the delivery than in making human contact. It was my turn to make the delivery, and the neighborhood was downright depressing. Some of these places just didn't look fit for human habitation, because of course they weren't. And that's why I thought, these people can use some Christmas cheer. So I walked up onto this one porch. I knocked on the door. Nothing. Nobody. Nobody's home, I guess. I tried it again. Nope. Nobody's home, I guess. Almost enjoying the thought. Just to be sure, I knocked one more time. Nothing. Nobody's home. Too bad. And my friends were growing impatient and started honking the horn. Then suddenly his face was at the door, staring at me through the screen. It was a black face. I had not seen it at first in the shadows of the evening. But all of a sudden, there it was, and he said, "Hi." I said, "Oh, hi." He said, "What can I do for you?" I thought to myself, uh-oh, what do I do now? I was just trying to leave a basket and now I'm in a conversation with a real live poor person. Then another face appeared. The face belonged to a woman. She said, "Hi." I said, "Hi." And she said, "Won't you come in?" "Come in?" This wasn't working out like I planned. "Sure, I'll come in." And they introduced themselves in the living room. "I'm Benjamin Johnson. This is my wife, Claire." I thought to myself, how odd they have names. "And your name?" "Who, me? I'm Robin Myers, Plymouth Church, part of the youth group." "Oh, yes," said Claire Johnson. "Big church, beautiful church." And then, from another room, appeared a little boy, looked to be about 9 or 10, and he smiled and said, "What's in the basket?" I'd forgotten I was even holding a basket, and I said, "Oh, Merry Christmas," and I handed him the basket. He took it from me, and get this, he started getting into the basket, unwrapping the paper. And he took out an apple as if he intended to eat it. I'm thinking to myself, this is not working out like I planned. And then he did something really weird. He got out a second apple, and get this, he handed it to me. He gave me some of my own fruit. I'm thinking to myself, stupid kid doesn't know how charity works. He's given me back my own stuff. Well, what was I supposed to do? I'm supposed to be humble, so I took it. I took a bite out of it, and I thought to myself, well, here I am, sitting in the home of real live poor people with real names, eating out of my own sack. But I'll never forget what I learned that day. I learned something as powerful and important as anything I've ever learned in my life. It shapes my theology, my politics, my family life, my understanding of God. And it's very simple until you think about it. All of us, and I do mean all of us, we eat out of the same basket. Not mine and yours and his and hers and ours and theirs. No more, what do you people want? But what do all of us want to become? Because however we like to hide it, behind slogans of the self-made man and manifest destiny and survival of the fittest, the truth is we all eat out of the same basket. We all eat together. The world's not our project, our opportunity to take from the poor and give to the rich and sanctify our guilt with a little charity at Christmas time. We're all in this together. The church has this message to bring. We've got to stop thinking of ourselves as if some are entitled and others are not, and recover our true first premise of faith. Imago Dei, made in the image of God. Some theologians call it primal memory. This belief that we're from God and to God, and that life is but this parenthesis in which we're called to remember where we came from, where we're going, and to whom we belong. Because the real message of Genesis is not we're infected with badness, but that God made the plants and the trees and the vegetation and said, that's good. Then God made the light, greater to rule the day, lesser to rule the night, and the stars, and God saw that it was good. Then God filled the sea with fish and the sky with birds and even great sea monsters. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind. It's a beautiful description of evolution. And it was so. And God saw that it was good. And then God made something else slowly out of the primal ooze of nothingness. God made a creature who could write poetry, paint masterpieces, raise Lazarus from the dead with medicine as well as with faith. And after God had made humankind in God's own image, it is the only time when God says, not this is good, but this is very good. And what God made was you and me. And if we put ourselves down, that's a sin. And not a very original one. When God made you and me and Benjamin and Claire Johnson and every other human being in the world, God said, this is the very best I can do. As the Ephesians letter puts it, you are God's masterpiece. So the next time someone does something truly extraordinary, something good and decent and grand and hopeful, just say, well, she's human. Hey, great cake, Grandma. Well, child, I'm human. Nice catch, Mr. Third Baseman. Well, I'm human. Take a look at the person sitting to your left. Turn to your left and look at the person. Now turn to your right and look at the person sitting to your right. You know what you're looking at? It's the image of God. And every time you live up to your inheritance instead of living down to your sickness, you are recreated in the image of God. And the next time you think you can't do something, just remember, hey, I'm human. When I consider the heavens, the work of God's fingers, the moon and the stars, I think, what are persons that you are conscious of them, women and men and girls and boys, just like us? And the answer comes back, clear as a bell, this I have made in my own image, only slightly less than myself. Do you believe that? In the church, if we believe something, we say amen. So do you believe that? And if you do, let the people say amen. Amen.